Welcome to another broadcast of Philosophic Perspectives on the Artist First Radio Network. All past broadcasts are archived. You can pick them up at artistfirst.com. And as I like to say, here he is, the smartest guy in the room, your host, Arthur D. Schwartz.
Hi, everybody. Nice to be with you again. By the way, I just turned on the seed waiting, and I want to thank Novel Venture to speak about my show. I appreciate that. And this is about today's show is going to be about hypnotism and philosophy. Now, I want to talk a little bit about that because my hypnotherapy practice is, I think, kind of unique in the way I got into it. I was in the peer. Philosophy has been sort of my lifelong passion, so I've been studying that for many, many years. I had a business back in the late 90s, well, before the 80s and 90s, and it was coming to its end. And I began to look for other professional avenues, and I discovered a strange thing called hypnotherapy. Honestly, I didn't even know what it was at the time. And it quickly captivated me. And the reason it was so interesting to me because I saw a correlation between hypnotism and philosophy. And that is really where the quest began. As a matter of fact, the book, which I speak a lot about, Ethical Empowerment, Virtue Beyond the Paradigms, was originally conceived of as basically a book about philosophy and hypnosis. I mean, I think the original title had that. The philosophy and hypnosis might have been the title I had in mind. As I worked on it, it kind of moved away. It became more philosophical than about more philosophy than and hypnotism. But hypnotism is still an important theme in the book. Now, why is that? What is the hook that got me navigating between those two fields? Well, the interconnections are very, very broad, are very, very extensive. At the time, though, what I centered in on was the idea of philosophy being your conscious belief system. We can talk about our philosophy all day long, stand on our soapbox, and keep talking about our values and our beliefs, and that dirty word, ideology. Those of you who know much about my thinking, I'm not a big fan of ideology, period. As a matter of fact, I look at hypnotherapy as an art of escaping ideology, escaping being hypnotized in the negative sense. But we'll get into that in a minute. So you have philosophy being all about your belief system and justification of beliefs, and philosophies are the very conscious ideas we have that as we see the world and our place in it, and that's just one of the very many, many, many definitions of philosophy. One of the most simple ones, really. But when I became acquainted with hypnosis and the whole field of hypnotism, I quickly realized, well, geez, there are these subconscious beliefs too. And there's got to be an important link between the subconscious mind and the conscious mind. Now, nowadays, I think that's generally well understood, although not really, not always. I mean, you can say, well, with Freud and the psychologists who came after Freud, Jung, and others, that it's obvious. But it really isn't, and not even today is our thinking about philosophy and the philosophical implications of politics or just everyday decisions are the subconscious components evaluated. And you see, that's the thing about hypnosis, rather. I wanted to kind of clarify two ways or versions of the word hypnosis or hypnotic. In the very practical or very professional or formal sense, it's something that occurs in an office And a hypnotist such as myself would hypnotize a person into a trance state. It's like a daydream state. Oh, it is various versions of it. Some are deeper, some are more sleep-like, some are very just a light lethargy feeling. So that's in the professional sense. That's why there's various levels of hypnosis, but it's something that's done in the office, in the light states and the deeper states. But in the vernacular, in the everyday use of the terms, they're very, very different. When you say, oh, he hypnotically went about his business, or she was hypnotized by this person who entered the room. And the words, I mean, it's used in so many different ways. And many of the uses of the term become negative because it becomes rather robotic. Like you're hypnotically going about your business without thinking about it. You're hypnotically thinking the same thing over and over and over again. Or you get hypnotized by the roads, road hypnosis, by looking at those arrows in the street while you're driving, and you're getting put into a hypnotic state, which probably is not a good thing if you're driving a car. So you have these two distinctions between them, and that's very, very important because part of the show tonight is going to be an attempt on my part to explain what I feel is the difference between good hypnosis and hypnosis that's not so good, that might be negative. Now, I'm not talking about these false or these exaggerated ideas of these, you know, evil hypnotists who are controlling people. That is generally, I wouldn't say impossible, because I don't believe in any absolutes. I mean, I think there was something in the news a few years ago where some hypnotist or someone who was trained in hypnotism was going into banks in London and hypnotizing the teller to hand over the money. I believe I got that right. This was maybe 5 years ago, I want to say. I don't know if it's true. It was reported, by news outlets. So I'm assuming it was true. But generally speaking, I mean, because, you know, there's all kinds of explanations for that. Generally, I don't think someone can be actually hypnotized to do something she doesn't want to do. Of course, if the teller behind the bank thinks she's going to be shot, that hypnotist, quote unquote, thief, might have had an extra little bit of motivation to get the teller to do what she wanted, that he wanted her to do, if there was a gun involved, for example. So there's all kinds of reasons, reasons why sometimes it would seem like someone could be hypnotized and without permission. I guess it's possible, but highly, highly unlikely. There's a distinction between hypnosis and brainwashing, obviously. Hypnosis is done in just a few minutes. So if someone comes into my office, you know, and this person might spend an hour and a half or an hour, even 2 hours with me, working, talking and doing hypnosis. Brainwashing, you know, like the Stockholm syndrome, you got to have somebody locked up, broken off all communication to the outside world, and be violent with the person. So there's a big difference. Brainwashing is forcing someone to do something against his or her will, and for such a long period of time that, for example, in the Patty Hearst case, where the victim, begins to sympathize with her captors. Hypnosis is diametrically opposed. It's exact opposite. I should say hypnotherapy, the professional use of hypnosis, is diametrically opposed to that. Because what hypnotherapy is designed to do is to get a client or a hypnotic subject to do what he or she wants to do. So if you want to quit smoking, hypnosis can help you quit smoking. If you want to manage your anxiety better, hypnosis can help you manage your anxiety better. If hypnosis, if you have a very bad habit that you're trying to control, if you have a bad temper that you want to manage, and hypnosis can help you do that. So hypnotherapy is, a form of empowerment the way it's used. So that's an important distinction. It might seem relatively obvious, but I found from experience that it really isn't. I get a kick at it sometimes when I tell people, when I meet somebody and I tell them what I do. It's always like that big, eyes open up and, oh my gosh, I don't know what's going through their mind. But it's kind of funny. I'll never forget the time I moved into my current office in Newton, Massachusetts. And the landlord had a business associate up there. And I was standing on the stairs. She pointed to him, me to him, and here's the guy, he's a hypnotist. And he was looking at it. Then I looked at him straight, eyeball to eyeball, and I pointed a finger at him. And he began to actually, with fright, began to disappear into the corner so he couldn't see me. And I know it sounds kind of ridiculous, but actually it happened. So there's all kinds of funny ideas about hypnosis. Sometimes the only experience that people have with hypnosis are stage shows where people are, hypnotized to act like idiots or some, hysterical sexual, hypnosis, so-called sexual hypnosis, doing funny things on stage, inappropriate things, so forth, in good taste. But the thing is, stage hypnosis is very different than clinical hypnotherapy because these people are the most, they're screened to be the most suggestible people you can get in the crowd. And also, you have a lot of social dynamics, a lot of people around, half the audience is drunk out of their mind and everyone is laughing. And so I'm not saying they're not hypnotized, but it's a very special kind of hypnosis, which is to a large degree dependent upon the situation. Not necessarily. A good stage hypnotist, can do incredible things, but that hypnosis is not really typical of the kind of work that I'm talking about today. Well, I'm meandering a bit, but I'm just talking a little bit about the nature of hypnosis and on this relationship with philosophy. So I'm going to get into it now, in my book Ethical Empowerment, the chapter part 1.4, I open up with this the sentence. I say, "We are hypnotized in the present and conditioned by the past." What does that mean? Well, there again, there's a difference of what hypnosis means. Because a lot of hypnosis has to do with a suggestion right there in the moment of time that gets a person to absorb it and to do something or to think something or think about something in a certain way. And that's an important part of hypnosis, the moment to influence a person. I like to give the example always about that when we talk about free will and small changes and, and the thing about it is just a little free will makes a big difference. So the example I give is you're driving from Boston, that's my neck of woods, out to L.A., and I make just a tiny little wrong turn, just a little bit. But you know what? It escaped my notice, and I didn't realize it. And so just kept on going, and suddenly I'm driving all this way, and suddenly I see a sign that says, "Welcome to Mexico." I'm making this up, obviously. Well, the point being, a little change can go a long, long way. A little change can go a long way when it comes to driving a car or following directions. A little shift. But the same thing applies to thought. A little subtle thought change, alteration, can make a whole lot of difference. I noticed I was talking on the phone just the other day, and I was talking to, I won't mention who, but someone, and I would just mention on an aside, oh, well, just during this conversation, I thought about this idea. And anyway, so then we were talking, and then this other person said, he just repeated my same words. You know, I don't know. We were just having, I don't know why, but I just think that I had this conversation, and I think this is what we should do. And I realized that inadvertently, I gave this person a suggestion, which he picked up. And that is one of the ways hypnosis works. It's because it's a form of misdirection. You know, there is some people confuse hypnosis and magic. They're not the same thing at all, but they are connected because they both rely on misdirection. You know, the magician will misdirect your attention so that you don't see what he's doing to make the trick work. And I don't know anything about magic, but I know that's the way it works. I mean, the audience is being misdirected and doesn't see what the hypnotist, what the magician is doing. Well, in hypnosis, it's similar. It's one of the ways of getting hypnotized getting someone hypnotized is to misdirect, so that while that person is misdirect, think about something else that's said inadvertently or indirectly or metaphorically sinks in. That's the way you get a message that sinks into the subconscious mind, by misdirection. So there is a connection between hypnotism and magic. And we will talk about magic, the way we'll talk, the way you would spell that word here would be M-A-G-I-K. So that's usually occult magic, or that's one of the topics that I think I'm going to talk a little bit about. And I know I stated in the show description on the Meetup radio site. Okay, so I hope I'm getting somewhere here. Now, so having said that, we have these things with hypnosis about, so actually I want to just, you know, so I got off on this tangent because we're talking about the very moment in time where someone gets hypnotized. And that is contradistinguished by the habitual nature that hypnotherapy can produce, that hypnosis can produce. So then you find this person continues to do the same old, same old, same old thing. Maybe he had a bad habit, now he has a good habit. So many times in the vernacular, hypnosis means that robotic thinking, that robotic behavior, the guy's like a robot, he's hypnotized, he's not thinking. That's a very, very important topic, because the truth of the matter is that can be good or that can be bad. That can be, you can, to be very robotic and do things automatically and have very good habits can be a great thing. But it can also be a horrible thing if the habit's a bad habit, or if the habit used to be a good habit but becomes a bad habit because it could become rusty and is no longer applicable. So this whole thing between catching the moment where the initial hypnotic suggestion occurs and then reinforcing the change is something that has extremely important philosophical qualities, I would argue. Philosophical qualities, because if thinking is important, if free will is important, if values are important, if beliefs are important, naturally, it's important to understand how these things get started from the get-go. So I would call here a balance between the creative and the redundant. Because creativity, in a way, you can argue, is an expression of freedom, and we think of it sometimes as being non-hypnotic because you're breaking barriers, you're breaking the tethers of thought and creating something new, as opposed to the redundant, which is the reinforcement. But, of course, I realize as I say that some would argue, well, no, creative is very hypnotic, because with hypnosis you can free the mind to break through the old barriers, the old tethers, the old boxes that's been keeping it back. So you can see the word can be used in so many different ways. The word hypnosis is not good, not bad. It's just a word. But I think it is important to clarify the different meanings so that we can understand its positive uses and the uses that may be negative and not good. And an example of the negative, let me see, I'll look at the time here for a minute. Yeah, I'll just speak a little bit more before the break. The negative can occur, or we can see in politics, for example. Well, of course, many people might know that Adolf Hitler was often referred to, or he is described as having almost hypnotic qualities that, that got the people to do, go down the road that they went down. Of course, there's a lot more than just his speaking style, but he was kind of an evil. You wouldn't call that hypnotism. I mean, let's face it. He said the things he said, and he had Goebbels and all that, but he also had the stormtroopers to back him up. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's not just about a lot of words. It requires more than that. But I want to give you an example of what I consider to be negative hypnosis in some of this incredible election year that we've been witnessing. I know I'm kind of talking the roundabout, but I think I hope you're following me because the points I'm making are pretty consistent. I'm talking about the nature of hypnosis and the various ways that it's practiced. Now, here's the thing I noticed about Donald Trump. I think he is a little bit, he's a very shifty fellow. He really is, because here's just two things I wrote down. So one thing that I noticed is, I mentioned this, I think, in an earlier show, but this is an example of what I'm saying, that when it came out that he was supported by David Duke, the Klansman, I think former state representative, neo-Nazi. And someone had asked him, what do you think about David Duke's endorsement? Do you accept it? Do you reject his endorsement? And he said, I don't know anything about David Duke, so I don't know if I'm going to reject it. I don't know. He says, if he endorsed me, it's okay with me, or something like that. I'm paraphrasing. What I just said there was not an exact quote. But he sort of fluffed it off as not a big deal. And he said he never heard of David Duke. Never heard of him. But then, a couple of days later, I was reading their column, and it just became reported that in the 90s, Trump was on the Today Show with Matt Lauer, and he was rebuking David Duke as someone, that he was a bad person, so forth and so on. Then Trump again said, oh, of course I don't like David Duke. I talked about that. I was interviewed and talked about that on TV, on the Today Show. I'm paraphrasing this, but I'm stating the facts, even though I'm not stating exact making exact statements about what was said specifically, but I'm stating the facts, the content. Now, what happened there? This is the thing. What he did, he outrageously seemed to condone on some level this guy David Duke, and then he backed off, and then he said, of course I'm not in favor of that. Well, here's the thing. That's a hypnotic technique. Because you're confusing the public. You're saying something, and then you got it out there, and then, of course I didn't say it, I didn't mean it. And so meanwhile, what happened is the people who needed to know that he was okay with David Duke, because at that time he knew he was on the Today Show with Matt Lauer, and had formally rejected him. But this time he said, I never heard of David Duke. He literally said, and this I'm quoting directly, I never heard of David Duke. That is pretty scary. But the thing is, the guy just lies all the time. He doesn't know when to stop. Here's another one that he does. He's going out. His behavior, of course, is well documented, unprecedented in my lifetime, and if ever, you know, it's just he swears, he's just outrageous in his public demeanor, or has been until now. He's decided to be a nice guy. I think he's changed. Well, that's happening again. So now, yesterday, I think I was watching the TV, and now he was saying, "Well, I'm going to be different as president. Yes, I'm going to tone down." Well, here's the thing. He did it. He went out there. Did you know one thing about a hypnotic technique is to say something in the context of extreme excitation, or if you know you'll always remember what happened. You know, just before a bomb went off. That's of course, unless you were hurt, when you remember anything. But I mean, something traumatic would happen, and so provided you weren't stunned and physically harmed, you would likely remember things extremely well. And when you say something with an extreme sort of excitement atmosphere, you tend to remember that. And so here's the thing. He is who he is, and now suddenly he's going to be a nice guy. But it's too late. It's too late. And so what's happened is he's accomplished his end to make certain things acceptable that weren't otherwise, because he set a precedent. Well, I'm going to leave it at that for the time being, Scott. We're going to take a break, and I'll be back shortly. Stay tuned.
In Ethical Empowerment, Virtue Beyond the Paradigms, Arthur D. Schwartz presents an ethical theory that is a framework for evaluating moral conundrums that go beyond legalistic rulemaking, dogmatism, and preconditioned thinking. The book is as much an ethical framework for unconventional ideas as it is for staying with convention. Ethical Empowerment is a manifesto of non-doctrinaire perspective. Ultimately, the hypnotic thinking of ideology and dogmatism can only be overcome by returning to the true source and essence of morality, which is nothing less than universal love. Discover how the philosophically liberating approach of the ethical empowerment can be applied to the range of ethical, social, and political controversy. Read about a plan to eliminate all political parties. Entertain the possibility of an overhaul of the patent system and its replacement with a system that rewards inventors while eliminating monopolistic control of patents and technological suppression. Many other transformative ideas are discussed in the book, including issues related to the monetary system, real estate, scientific paradigms, and a rational approach to conspiracy theory. While Ethical Empowerment will challenge your mind to consider new perspectives, the ethical challenge is always to keep the diversity, depth, and breadth of perspective within the boundaries of love. Ethical Empowerment is available at Amazon.com and most online booksellers in both print and ebook editions.
This is Arthur D. Schwartz. You know, beliefs and disbeliefs can be very powerful. Much like philosophy, hypnotism is concerned with belief. Hypnotherapy, a practical application of hypnotism, may largely be described as the practice of removing false beliefs that form mental blocks to success, to happiness, and to well-being. In my hypnotherapy and philosophical counseling practice, I combine my work in philosophy with hypnotism in order to clear mental blockages that can occur on both conscious and subconscious levels. A mental block may be conscious or subconscious and can be expressed, for example, in the form of anxiety, low self-esteem or low motivation, bad habits, tobacco habits, weight gain, low performance, and much more. If you are interested in using hypnosis and the power of the mind to overcome mental blocks and barriers that have emerged in your life, please feel free to give me a call at 617-964-4800 or visit www.integralhypnosis.com. That's integralhypnosis.com.
Thanks for joining us on this edition of Philosophic Perspectives on the Artist First Radio Network. Let's get back to your host, Arthur D. Schwartz.
Welcome back. So I was talking about the political, right now as we speak, the political uses of persuasion that are somewhat hypnotic. So I want to read this well-known passage by Nietzsche. Which I love. According to nature, you want to live. Oh, you noble Stoics, for all your love of truth, you have forced yourselves so long, so persistently, so rigidly, hypnotically, to see nature as the wrong way, namely Stoically, that you are no longer able to see her differently. And some abysmal arrogance finally still inspires you with the insane hope that because you know how to tyrannize yourselves, Stoicism is self-tyranny. Nature, too, lets herself be tyrannized. Is not the Stoic a piece of nature? So that's one of the first statements or references to hypnosis by a great philosopher. I mean, when I started doing the research going back in the to the late 90s is when I started most of the research in this area. And so he's talking about how Stoicism, you know, they've hypnotized into thinking that self-tyranny is the way of nature. And so let me repeat this again. Stoicism is self-tyranny. Nature, too, lets herself be tyrannized. Is not the Stoic a piece of nature? So, in other words, the travail, the Stoic who is so calm, so calm under all kinds of horrific situations, I think that's the ideal Stoic, who represses his emotions, represses the anger. Is that natural or is that unnatural? Well, you know, here we go again. It's all about balance. You know, I think Stoicism is great, actually. It's just that when it's taken to extreme, I don't think emotions are there to be extirpated, to be repressed. I think emotions are a good thing. Sometimes they need to be repressed. Sometimes they need to be acknowledged without expressing them because we learn from them. But I don't think we have emotions so that we pretend that they don't exist. And so it's probably not natural, but it explains how philosophically you can begin to believe anything if you hypnotize yourself enough to believe it. Now, another philosopher who I think expresses hypnosis in a negative way. This time, he is the one that's being hypnotized, I would say, is one of Hegel. One of my favorite philosophers that I like dumping on. He was a great philosopher, too. And so I want to get this passage here. I may not be able to find it in time. Okay, well, I'm going to continue looking. I'll go on. I actually didn't mark it. But The thing with Hegel is he created this dialectic, and it's basically a kind of very similar to Aristotelian logic, and so for him, whatever he concludes feels is absolute truth. And so here is this awful, awful, awful phrase that he wrote. This argument is called the master-slave dialectic. And this one here is coming from his philosophy of history. It's most well known in the phenomenology of spirit, but in his work, his historical work, the philosophy of history. Okay, existing in a state, slavery is itself a phase of advance from the merely isolated sensual existence, a phase of education, a mode of becoming participant in a higher morality and the culture connected with it. Slavery is, and for itself, injustice, for the essence of humanity is freedom. But for this, man must be matured. The gradual abolition of slavery is therefore wiser and more equitable than its sudden removal. So here he uses philosophy, basically, to justify slavery. He acknowledged it's evil, and yet, because there has to be a maturation process, he justified it. And why? Who said? I mean, it had already been abolished at certain parts. This was not long ago. I mean, it was a long time ago, but not relatively speaking historically. This is around the 1840s, I believe. Some parts of the world had already abolished slavery. And here he is justifying slavery because of some cockamamie idea that this is the way it's necessary for the slaves, because they're necessarily a way to the, for them to be matured, to mature, or the process to be matured. I say, wiser and more equitable. The proper question is, who was in need of maturation, the slave or the enslaver? To dismiss Hegel's logic as merely a product of its time, to some degree, can be accepted as a simple fact, and it can be unfair to judge thinkers in terms of thinking that evolves generations later. However, it can also be argued that this sort of acceptance becomes just another Hegelianism that rationalizes and present and avoids the duty of deep moral reflection. Are we all merely product of our times, intractably stuck in the quagmire of the prevailing ignorance? Hegel argues that there is no escape from history's dialectic, and therefore it was necessary that slavery be tolerated until consciousness evolved. However, by accepting one of history's most heinous institutions as unavoidable and necessary, and failing to resist it, is to knowingly cave into a moral actuality known to be wrong on the deepest levels, indefensible on the basis of love, and defensible by no means other than love of dogma. And so that's just exactly what these things are. I talked about hypnosis in terms of the initial idea, and then the sense of hypnosis as reinforcing the change. And hypnosis does both of those things. You insert the suggestion, and then you reinforce. And we can see how something that by nature is incomprehensibly evil, and yet somehow it's justified. That's because that's what ideology does. That's why I like to think of myself as the arch enemy of ideology. I actually don't believe in any ideology. Now, what I mean by that, I certainly realize there's some ideologies that are very beautiful and very loving and all that. The problem is that an ideology is by definition inflexible, ultimately. And so I just assume stay away from them and operate on the basis of a kind of thinking that always tethers itself to loving intention in the principles that are implied. Anyway, that's the heart, I think, of or the major theme of my book, that you want to escape ideology, escape dogma. So therefore, essentially, in my view, hypnosis is about freedom. Hypnosis, we can use hypnosis to enslave, to get the people to be slaves of their own thinking, of their own ideologies, of their own obsequiousness, to make themselves slaves to the government, for example. Or we can hypnotize to follow the command of your heart, of your rationality, of your kindness, of your decency, of your compassion, of your thinking, of your knowing. And of course, you know, that's that principle that Thoreau talked about in his essay, Civil Disobedience. There comes a time, I mean, by and large, we always need to keep, we need to follow the laws. I'm not for law breaking. However, sometimes, if the law is that evil, we must stand up. And so this is, you can, once again, I'm hoping, I'm suggesting to everyone the interconnections between hypnosis and philosophy. Because there's a strong correlation between the subject of hypnosis and the subconscious versus the rational mind. And philosophy and freedom. Because, you see, we have to, on one hand, be open and to act on our own free will based on loving intention. But at the same time, we can't be completely so free that there's no conditioned behavior, there's no habits. We just have to make a decision with every single thing we do. Like brushing your teeth in the morning. That's impossible. We haven't evolved that way. We need to rely on habits. So it seems to me the solution is mindfulness, a mindful behavior, a mindful state of mind, where we appreciate the need to change, and we appreciate the need to develop good habits, good behaviors. You know, this is very consistent with the Serenity Prayer, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. You can use the word God in the beginning or not. It's up to you. But the original Serenity Prayer, which was written by the Reverend Reinhold, I'm forgetting his name. Reinhold Niebuhr, a German pastor who was actually practiced on Cape Cod. This actually happened in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, but he's a German native, I believe. And the Serenity Prayer, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that can be changed and should be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference. I mean, that's just it right again. Again, we need to know when to accept, and that's okay to hypnotically, if you want, redundantly, habitually accept what needs to be accepted. That's a choice. And, you know, the difficult part is the third part where, you know, the wisdom to know the difference. That people are going to have disagreements. You know, some would say, don't change. Some would say, change. That's okay. Everyone has to make a decision for themselves. But you see, that's just it. Know when you just have to do what you need to do, and then know when you are able to take it upon yourselves to break new ground and make a difference. I think that is a major, major principle. And that in itself does reflect the picture of an inspired hypnosis, inspired hypnotic belief. Mastering the courage to change and accepting the courage to toe the line. We got to pick our spots. We can't change everything. And so that is something that is, I would say, encapsulates my point of view. That kind of friend, the serenity prayer, is really an antidote to ideology and dogma. Now, there's a lot. You know, I mentioned Nietzsche, who wrote a lot about not yet doesn't use the word hypnosis too much, I don't think, but he recognizes the subconscious and unconscious in philosophy. That's another term to distinguish, subconscious and unconscious. Sometimes they're used interchangeably, but I think they're useful where subconscious is more subliminal, more on the surface, things that are, you don't know, you don't remember, but they're accessible. And then you have the unconscious, which are deep, deep, deep. Sometimes they're not even talking about beliefs. I mean, they can be unconscious beliefs, but that would include also the autonomic nervous system, everything that is going on in your body and in your mind, in your brain, that you're unaware of, but very, very, very deeply repressed beliefs. Sometimes it might refer to as unconscious. I mean, this is my choice. And subconscious is, that's what I work with. I mean, mostly the subconscious. You're dealing with beliefs that are below the surface, that are forgotten, but are causing all kinds of mischief. Now, okay, Scott, I'm going to take another break. We'll be back shortly.
Are you a person who enjoys intellectual social interaction and finds digging deeper into the nature of things, from big issues to everyday life, an important part of the pleasure of life? Social Philosophizers is a Boston area social club for those who desire intellectual socializing. It's a club for both singles and non-singles, and for anyone who finds intellectually mingling to be the best form of social mingling. The club offers a variety of interesting venues, such as philosophical get-togethers in private venues, book discussions concerning literature and philosophy, topical discussions over brunch or dinner, guest speakers, theater, after-work mixers, even long philosophical ruminations along nature trails or city streets, and more. If you live in the greater Boston area or occasionally spend time in the area, you can choose a cost-effective membership level that's right for you. Basic membership is free. Find the link on Arthur's Philosophical Perspectives show page at artistverse.com or just search socialphilosophizers.com. We hope you'll join Social Philosophizers today. That's socialphilosophizers.com. You must be one of the way cool people because you are listening to Philosophic Perspectives on the Artist First Radio Network. Now back to your host, Arthur D. Schwartz.
Hey, cool. Thank you, Scott. All right. I'm going to just mention a few philosophers here. I just want to state that I already mentioned Nietzsche, another of major philosopher in the history of the subconscious and the unconscious mind would be Arthur Schopenhauer. The funny story about Schopenhauer, in his book, which I'm forgetting the name of his major work, but he talked about the same things that Freud was, you know, the sublimation of the, you know, the ego, the, you know, the repression of sexual, you know, sexual, in, you know, sexuality and so forth and so on. You know, the whole Freudian thing, you know, the ego, super ego, ego id, you know, and he, it's all there. I mean, Schopenhauer, I mean, it's all there. I mean, it's amazing. Schopenhauer wrote about, I would say, 60, 70 years, even, well, may, or arguably 80 years before, I say 70 years before Freud. And so here's what I read, that Freud was challenged with this. He said, you know, Schopenhauer was writing many of the same things that, that you're talking about now. And from what I recall reading is you know, what's his Freud, what Freud said in response was, oh yes, well of course, however, that was not science. So there you go. That's a, that would get me, that will get me off on that my whole nother topic there, my favorite topic of scientists who are so smug that they think that this is, that's bad. So, and you know, talk about bad science. I mean, that's what basically Freud did. I mean, with bad science, I mean, he was a philosopher, a practicing philosopher, I would say, not much of a scientist. And so, but he, because in his mind, what Schopenhauer did was not science, it didn't really count. What he did was science, so that he can be called the founder of this, of the unconscious mind. Ridiculous. So Schopenhauer is another important one. You know, the whole German Romantic movement that came before Schopenhauer, in a very general way, was very instrumental in our ideas of the subconscious mind. Now, there was a book that came out, and I actually purchased the three volumes of it. I can't say I've read it, but I'm going to at some point. It's called The Philosophy of the Unconscious by Edward von Hartmann. A very popular book in the day. It was written in the late 19th century. It was very influential on Freud and on Jung. And and they, you know, they acknowledge that. There's another novel that's great that some of you may know. It's called When Nietzsche Wept by Dr. Irvin Yalom, very well-known psychiatrist. And it's a novel about the relationship between the young Freud and Nietzsche. Great book. Really a great book. So I'm just just throwing out a few points here on the relationship between philosophy and hypnosis. There's just two more points I want to make. One would be the subject of virtue. So compare Socrates with Lao Tzu. I think they were basically contemporaries, actually. Lao Tzu in China, in the Greek Socrates, I think they roughly lived around the same time, I believe. And so Socrates is well known as, he didn't write anything, he never put anything in writing, but maxim, the unexamined life is not worth living. Lao Tzu, however, talked about virtue in such a way that if the master or if the actor thinks about what he does, then he's not truly virtuous. For Lao Tzu, virtue is the almost hypnotic action, expression of virtue without thinking. Well, you see, so in this case, I definitely side with Socrates. However, once again, you can certainly see what Lao Tzu is saying. There's nothing like a man who, or woman, who does something just without thinking, and they are applauded and admired because she didn't even have to think to do the virtuous thing. So absolutely, I applaud that behavior. That is the person we all would like to be, who automatically seems like, you know, they've been here before. Those people seem so, have wisdom so instilled that it becomes natural to them. So yes, I understand what Lao Tzu is saying. That's true virtue. However, number one, I would say, if you have to think about it, and then you act virtuously, I would say that's a good thing too. I would say probably a better thing, because the truth is, if you don't examine, if you don't think, are you trying to say this virtuous person can't make a mistake? Of course she can. We're all fallible. We're all fallible beings. So I'm on Socrates' side here. They both make excellent points, but for me, the unexamined life is not worth living, which means examine your life. It's virtuous. It's worth living a life that's examined, that's reflected, upon, and that you think about before doing. Of course, the expression, think before you act, is a well-known maxim. And I don't think that Lao Tzu can contradict that. Think before you act. Now, I just want to talk a little bit about another topic I mentioned in the description, which I really haven't gotten into, but it's in terms of the philosophical sense of mysticism and hypnosis. I did talk about it a little bit in terms of creativity, because when you're dealing with the mystical intuitions and you're dealing with creativity, you seem to be dealing in that realm that is not tied down by rules and categories and stipulations and definitions. It just smoothly spills over into a high level of consciousness and intuition. And so there is a linkage between mysticism and philosophy, and I've done a show on this, or shows similar to it. I did make reference actually on the page, which my computer turned off now, but of a couple of well-known books on the subject of paranormal phenomena and the philosophic implications. Before we My computer just wants to always shut down, so it looks like I may not be able to do that. Let's try this one thing here. Let's see if I can get it. Yep, here it is. Okay, I'm going to read this one little paragraph that I wrote on the description of this show. While the nature of hypnosis became understood as more properly a function of suggestion than spirituality, as an example in Mesmer, the linkage between hypnosis and spirit and or transcendental mind has persisted in the minds of many metaphysically minded people. The interconnections between the natural state, now called hypnosis, and psychic phenomena grew stronger in the 19th century. This is seen in such classic works as The Law of Psychic Phenomena by the American Thomson J. Hudson. It's a good book. And Human Personality and Its Survival of Bodily Death by F. H. Myers. The latter was one of the founders of the Society for Psychical Research in Britain. Both Hudson and Myers believed that the subjective mind or the subliminal mind had connections with spirit or with psychic or paranormal phenomena, which are obscured and covered up by the activity and interference of the conscious mind. They have in parapsychological research, you know, they put you in these sound, you know, these silent chambers. I forget what they call isolation chambers, and they find that psychic abilities seem to be helped by shutting out all kinds of interference. So that's a subject for another time. It's a subject that I've studied in the past, and I'm going to get more into, because without going into detail, and I have no time, but it's going to be in certain ways a continuation of, in a very, very indirectly, of my first book, Ethical Empowerment.
I feel that the linkage there, even though it's very indirect. So I want to say one more thing. So today's talk was hypnotism and philosophy. And I've been doing the show here for about a year now. I think, I just passed a year, I believe. And it's been mostly philosophy, and it's going to continue that. But I would be very interested in talking to some hypnotists out there. And I think there might be some listening today, or will be listening on a podcast, which, by the way, is downloadable. It's a free podcast. Each show is turned into a podcast by Scott within 24 hours, oftentimes sooner after the show. You can download it free. But if there are any hypnotists out there who might want to come on the show and be my and be my guest, please contact me at radio@arthurdschwartz.com. radio@arthurdschwartz.com, or you can just send it directly to arthur@arthurdschwartz.com, and I'll get it. So, actually, I shouldn't say I definitely get it, because they do have a spam problem. You can also send it to info@integralhypnosis.com. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed the show. I know I went over a lot of material. I did a lot of just sort of free surfing here, but I did have some points. I think I've made a few. I'm hoping I have. That how the nature of hypnosis, how important it is, and when used in a proper way in conjunction with philosophy, they each work to the benefit of the other. And I also did mention my philosophical counseling practice. So all these issues that I talk about, I practice or combine with a hypnotherapy. So my practice is a hypnotherapy and philosophical counseling practice. And I find that by using these themes, it helps my client gain greater clarity, because the block and the barrier to happiness is not always subconscious strictly, or not always conscious strictly, but a little bit of both. Well, thanks for listening once again. And so that does conclude tonight's program. And so for links to my book, Ethical Empowerment, my philosophical counseling and hypnotherapy practice, and the Social Philosophizers Club, please visit arthurdschwartz.com. I want to give many thanks to Scott once again for doing a great job. And this is Arthur D. Schwartz reminding you to live well and think deeply. So until next time, good night, everybody.
The new release, Without From Within, poems by Ron Shaw, is a must-read. One reviewer wrote, "The depth and imagery of these poems is of surpassing beauty. They flow and blossom from the pages, even as they rip the soul. This volume should be in every poem lover's library. Inspiring and fabulous." Another reviewer wrote, "The best poems are not just the ones that touch us through great turns of phrase, but the ones that tell a story to keep our mind reeling." Ron Shaw delivers on both counts, with wonderful concise tales from the whimsical to the existential, the dramatic to the heart-wrenching. Whether it is the social commentary of the dull or the relentless and intimate strength of the pulse, Shaw will keep you glued to the page with his thought-provoking verse. You won't want to miss Without From Within, poems by Ron Shaw, available at Amazon.com in English, as an audiobook and in paperback, and in both English and French as an ebook.
Hi, this is Joe.